Welcome, I'm Hanat Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today is September 11th. It's been 12 years since the Twin Towers fell, and still, Arab and Muslim Americans are feeling the effects of the Islamophobia that rippled through American society in the aftermath of 9/11. And it wasn't just prejudice on the street. The suspicion of Arab and Muslim Americans made its way into law through the Patriot Act and came to be codified in policies of profiling through the NYPD, the FBI, and the TSA. Just yesterday, the ACLU went to court to challenge the FBI on this count. The Civil Liberties Organization claims that the FBI has been running a, quote, troubling nationwide racial and ethnic mapping program that was used to spy on entire racial and ethnic groups based on nothing more than crude stereotypes. And last year, the Associated Press released a series of reports about the New York Police Department spying on Muslim Americans. Undercover agents went into mosques and made friends with people, trying to bait them into making inflammatory statements. And the reports reveal that all of this spying and infiltrating communities led to zero new leads on security or terrorist threats. So that leaves us to ask, what is the profiling program that is still in place 12 years ago after 9/11? What's the purpose of all this profiling? And what are the consequences for those who are targeted? Joining us is Zahra Bilu. She's a civil rights attorney and the executive director of the San Francisco Bay Area Office of CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations. CARE's mission is to enhance the understanding of Islam, encourage dialogue, protect civil liberties, empower American Muslims, and build coalitions that promote justice and mutual understanding. Zahra joins us by phone from Santa Clara, California. Hi, Zahra.
Hi, Hannah. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being on. And also with us is Abdi Sultani, executive director of the ACLU of Northern California. He says his passion for freedom of speech and constitutional protections is intensely personal as well as political. Abdi's early experiences were shaped by government abuse of power during his childhood in Iran before and after the Iranian Revolution. And Abdi joins us by phone from the East Bay. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. Well, today is 12 years since September 11th, 2001. As we all know, life for Arab Americans, for Muslim Americans, really changed after that day. What do each of you remember about that time after September 11th, 12 years ago? Zahra, what do you remember about that time immediately after 9/11?
You know, I remember the fear in the Muslim community of being attacked and profiled, and how that impacted women who, you know, were afraid to wear their headscarves, people who were being told that they had to come in and register at INS but didn't know if they'd ever be able to leave the buildings, religious leaders being swept up in raids. And it's sort of the type of frightening environment that you read about in history books but maybe you never imagine experiencing yourself.
And Abdi Sultani, what about you?
You know, I think the thing I would add to what Zahra just said is I also have this, memory of the way that the country came together around, you know, the values that make this country great. I think immediately after 9/11, there was a great sense of unity, of purpose as a country, and those values are the bedrocks of this country. So I think that, you know, I think what we saw in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 was both the kinds of rights violations that Zahra's talking about, but you also had this sense that as Americans we came together. And I think what's really transpired over this last decade is a way in which that unity of purpose has been abused to take away people's rights and basic protections under the Constitution. That's what really troubles me about the way in which the world has shaped itself after 9/11.
And so it's been 12 years. Do you think overall conditions are better or worse now for those who were targeted around after 9/11? Zahra, is it better at all now, 12 years ago?
I think the parts that are better are that more Americans are realizing what's happening to our civil liberties and that more American Muslims are feeling brave about standing up and challenging those violations. In terms of the actual civil liberties violations being perpetrated at the hands of the government, maybe less explicit, less in your face, but definitely still very problematic.
So still there.
Yeah.
Not going away 12 years later. Abdi, would you like to add something to that? How do you feel things are 12 years later?
You know, I think that one of the things that's really changed over the course of this last decade is the tremendous proliferation of technology and the role of a variety of technologies in the system of surveillance and profiling. You know, if you look back at 2001, we didn't have the level of information technology, and we didn't have the level of use of the internet, mobile devices that we have today. It's really amazing to think at how much technology has transformed our society over the course of this decade. So I think that one of the dynamics right now is the way in which technology itself is being used as a greater tool for surveillance, for profiling, than I think what we envisioned right after 9/11 was even possible.
So have those technological advances meant more precise targeting of people or just a better way to follow and target everybody?
Well, I think it's a combination. You know, one of the recent dynamics is that we are just now beginning to see what the scope of the use of technology in that surveillance has been. You know, when the Patriot Act was passed and over the course of the years as it's been amended, one of the major concerns of the ACLU and our partner organizations has been this use of technology for warrantless mass surveillance of Americans. And the recent disclosures made by, you know, the documents that Snowden released and what's, you know, coming out of that NSA programs is really starting to get people's attention that the scale of the collection of information is beyond anything that we had known before. Now, I think when you couple that with what we do know about the targeted surveillance of mosques, of religious leaders, of people based on national origin being from the Middle East or their religion, you know, I think that those are the two big pieces of the puzzle, and I think it's just now where we're beginning to see how those two things might be connected.
So now in connection with this Snowden revelations about the NSA spying, is that actually good news for the Muslim community in terms of, well, we're spying on everybody, it's not just you? Or is the number of people being spied on within Arab and Muslim communities still, you know, disproportionately large in terms of the general public? Zahra?
Well, the NSA spying is just one way in which the government surveils us. And so if we were to assume that the NSA surveils everybody and that other agencies are specifically focusing their attention on just the Arab and Muslim community, then it's still disproportionately large. I wouldn't call, nonetheless, the NSA news good news because it's still very frightening, right? It's, if anything, maybe it's an affirmation of what Arabs, Muslims, and South Asians have been saying for over a decade now, is that this is really problematic. And, you know, when they're done with us, everyone else will suffer. Is that when that they're sometimes, though it feels like there are two constitutions for different communities, that's not the case. Is that when the Arab, Muslim, and South Asian community loses their civil liberties, so do all Americans. And so maybe the silver lining is that this will help shake our fellow Americans into realizing that we are sort of in a very problematic state at this point.
And that kind of this is what Muslim and Arab Americans have been dealing with since
right,
9/11, now you know kind of thing.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So Zahra and Abdi, both of you follow cases of individuals and groups of people who are subject to this profiling and in many cases harassment. So if we can just get an example of some of these cases. Abdi, why don't we start with you? What are some of the cases that you're dealing with these days?
Well, you know, we have a range of cases throughout the country, and some of the ones that, you know, to me are just the most galling are when we have used the Freedom of Information Act to get access to FBI or other government records about the surveillance programs. So you'll see in some of the public records that we get from that, and obviously they redact a lot of information. But we learn, for example, about training materials about Muslim culture and the religion of Islam that were just full of, you know, all kinds of racial and ethnic stereotypes and falsehoods.
Can you give me an example of one, like, that really stood out for you?
You know, I think that one is where it talks about the Muslim religion as being particularly, you know, prone to violence. There's a variety of things that are like that. So, you know, I think that those types of training materials, to me, they reflected the mindset that this is a, you know, a flawed faith or a flawed religion, and that there are characteristics that are associated with people who have this faith that we should be suspicious of. You know, so those are the kinds of things that you see when you get into what are these some of these government documents that have been disclosed. But, you know, the extent of the profiling is quite large, and so we've seen many cases of, you know, one of the most galling to me was this program that we exposed with our partners that showed it was all under the auspice of outreach, where government officials, usually FBI, would go to mosques under the guise, I'm doing outreach, but all the information that was collected would go into intelligence files about individuals. So, you know, it's one thing to do outreach, it's another thing to gather information for intelligence purposes. And one of the Freedom of Information Act efforts that we undertook exposed the way in which this information that was for outreach was actually collected for intelligence purposes. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that really is, in our view, a fundamental violation of people's freedom of religion. When you're going to a mosque, you're exercising your freedom of religion that's protected by the First Amendment of the Constitution. So, you know, if an agent of the government comes and says, I'm doing outreach to get to know your community, you don't expect that to end up in an intelligence file on you.
Zahra Bilu, why don't you give me kind of a picture of what happens when these FBI outreach agents come to a mosque? What are they doing? What kind of questions are they asking? And what information are they gathering? Is it about the religious practices of people or what?
Sure. So the way in which we're hearing about these outreach visits happening is that, you know, FBI agents are saying to the community and to community leaders in particular, we want to build a good relationship with your community. We want to get to know you. You know, can you invite us to your place? Sometimes it's actually under the guise of we want to talk to you about your civil rights, which is, of course, incredibly problematic, if not funny. And sometimes it's we want to attend community events to just get to know the community members. And so you have these agents coming in sort of with approval at times from the mosque, not with mosque leaders maybe not realizing what the consequences are. And so they come in and they're talking to lay people in casual conversation. And so you have lay people who think, well, I'm getting to know the FBI agent, or this is good for me. Like, maybe like I'll like help educate them about Islam. And what the documents that the ACLU uncovered showed was that instead, what was happening was the agents were taking down notes about people's religious practices, about, you know, how many people, the ethnic breakdown, the Sunni Shia breakdown inside the, or makeup inside these organizations and events. And then, you know, even things as frightening as like the driver's license plate numbers or the license plate numbers of the cars in the parking lot. And we, you know, we think it's really important that our community members feel safe attending their places of worship and not have to worry about agents of the government talking to them, taking notes, and then putting that in intelligence files.
That's Zahra Bilou of CARE, and with me also is Abdi Sultani of the ACLU, and we're talking about profiling Arab Americans and Muslim Americans 12 years after 9/11. And we want to take your calls and your experiences and your questions for our guests. The number to give us a call at is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. What's been your experience in terms of profiling? Have you been profiled? Do you know somebody who's been profiled? A big place where the profile happens is in the airports. You know, many of my friends have been talking about, you know, these horrific stories at airports around the country because they either look Muslim or they have Muslim names. So if you've dealt with any of that, give us a call and tell us about your experience. 866-798-TALK. Or you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.com. So let's get into this this airport no fly list with like 500,000 people on it. Zahra, what are the origins of this no fly list, and did it just, you know, get much bigger after 9/11?
You know, I'm actually not sure what the origins of the list are. As I understand it, however, I mean, the government has always surveilled people and put them and scrutinized them and put them on various lists. But this no-fly list issue is one that's incredibly problematic because it will, for a number of reasons, right? But one, there are several watch lists. Nobody knows how you get on. Nobody knows how you get off. And you can be put on at any time without really any legitimate reason being provided. And the most frightening way in which this happens and where we've, you know, I think really made it a priority to help people is when they're traveling abroad. And so the clients that we represent are U.S. citizens who traveled abroad, who were not on a no-fly list when they left. And when they attempted to return home to the U.S., were told you can't board this plane because you're on a no-fly list, frequently without, you know, any reason being provided. And then the solution or the remedy option that's provided to them when this happens is, well, you can sit down with FBI agents to try to clear your name, except, you know, you're in Egypt, you're in Saudi Arabia, you're in Tunisia, you're in Yemen. You don't have access to an attorney. You thought you were going to go home, so you likely don't even have a place to stay, and you're being told, well, sit down with these FBI agents who might help you get off the list without any access to counsel.
And again, we're taking your calls at 866-798-TALK, or you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. So let's take a caller. Hi, Seema, welcome to Your Call.
Hi, how are you?
Hi. So what's been your experience?
Well, it's mainly in the airports and public transportation, especially the first years after September 11. I used to commute using the train here in New York, and it was really... nobody would come up and speak to me, but they were all, like, mumble under their breath, you know, this, you know, terrorist Muslim or whatever. But then it got to 2006, 2007 that I would try to travel within the U.S., and I would not be able to check in online. It would say for security measures, please show ID at the airport so you can check in. So I just went ahead and changed my last name. It was Hassan at that time, to a more non-Muslim name, which is my great-grandparents' last name. So,
and did it help after that? Did that
help?
Oh,
definitely. It definitely did. Yeah, my name, you know, without seeing me with the hijab and everything, you would never know that it's a Muslim name.
So do you think it was the look? Because you said you wear the hijab, the headscarf. Or was it the name? Or you don't know?
It was the look. When I do show up there, I would get the random searches, you know, from a long line, and I would be the only one singled out. But at the same time, it got to the name. Like I said, I wouldn't be able to check in online because of my last name. So it got very annoying, and I decided just to go ahead and go through the hassle of changing my last name.
And that made it better, but you, of course, you wouldn't go through the
hassle. Yeah, when you show up there, then you have the other, definitely then you would have to be randomly searched.
Is it getting better? Is it getting better now, do you think?
It is. And the TSA employees, I have to say, are much less aggressive than what they used to be. I travel a lot within the U.S. and back and forth from back home and here, and they are definitely much less aggressive and suspicious looking. And they, I feel like they do understand that it's a hassle, but it's something that they feel they have to do. And I don't know, you live with it, I guess. In the beginning, it was very stressful and you get very anxious, and you're worried that anything that might be happening, everybody will look at you. So, but now it's everybody, I guess, is getting used to it, or maybe getting more educated about it. So,
any worst airports to look out for?
I would say the Northeast is the best. I guess maybe they're used to more foreigners. Traveling to the Midwest was a pain. Atlanta was really not very nice. But otherwise, it's all in all, it's not too bad.
Okay.
It's getting better.
All right. Okay. Thank you so much, Seema.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. All right, Zahra and Abdi, so that's just one experience. Abdi, do you hear a lot of that?
You know, the airport no-fly lists are a really classic example of what the issues are that get raised, and it affects people with, Muslim or Middle Eastern names, and it also affects people based on other factors. One of the clients in an ACLU case right here in the Bay Area were a couple who had founded an anti-war magazine. And when they went to board a flight, they were told that their name is on a no-fly list and they were not allowed to board the flight. And that was because of the fact that we assume or suspect that it was because they were involved in publishing an anti-war publication. More recently, we just filed a lawsuit related to a group called Anti-War .com, or I should double check if we filed, but anyway, the antiwar.com is a group that publishes an online magazine, and they were being surveilled for their activities that are protected under the First Amendment for freedom of the press. So, the lists are core. When we talk about lists, what are they? They're long lists of names. How do you get on the list? How do you get off the list? How do you even know what lists exist? And I think one of the things that's happened is that everything is under this, veil of secrecy. The government has really walled off information from public scrutiny. And you can't even sometimes access the information because how can you prove that you're on the list if you don't have access to the list in the first place? So a lot of cases are dismissed for lack of standing. How can you show that you were harmed? And that's the standard that's often needed to bring a case. So I think that for me, one of my big kind of like 30,000 mile kind of observations of what's occurred is that we went from a model of government where the people have a right to privacy and we have the ability to look into the behavior and action of government to hold the government accountable. And I think now the tables have turned. I think that the government has this protection of secrecy, and from that bastion of secrecy, they now peer more deeply into our lives than ever before.
Speaking of government, Zahra, I think many people, when President Obama was elected, kind of breathed a sigh of relief. Yes, here he comes. The Patriot Act is going to go away. The surveillance is going to go away. The FBI is just going to stop surveilling. What was the reality and what has been the response?
You're right. I think people were incredibly hopeful, especially after 8 years of the Bush administration and everything that we'd seen. And though there are, many supporters of President Obama who still believe he's made progress, I believe it's fair to say that there is an incredible amount of disappointment that his words have not matched his actions. And he has continued to defend, if not further, the policies of the Bush administration. And so it's maybe a reminder to those that are advocates of civic engagement that civic engagement doesn't end on election day, that it continues in terms of holding our elected officials accountable and reminding them who elected them and what values they were elected on.
And we'll talk more about that after a break. That was Zahra Billu. With me also is Abdi Sultani. We're talking about profiling Arab and Muslim Americans. We'll talk more after a break.
Always better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, The number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. You can also send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org, feedback@yourcallradio.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Hanat Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, has the drug war affected you? We'll have a conversation with Eugene Jarecki, a filmmaker behind the documentary The House I Live In, which captures heart-wrenching stories from people at all levels of America's war on drugs. On Friday, it's our weekly media roundtable where we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. And today, 12 years after 9/11, how has racial profiling changed? Today, we're talking about what it's like to be profiled in the continuing war on terror. Arab and Muslim Americans still make up a disproportionate percentage of the no-fly list, for example. So has anything changed? And who is targeted and how? And what's the right way to evaluate security threats while protecting everyone's rights to freedom and privacy? You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And we really want to hear from you. If you've been targeted or profiled in the 12 years since 9/11, what's your experience been? Has changed, do you think? And do you think things are better or worse now in terms of profiling Arab Americans and Muslim Americans? And with me is Zahra Bilou, Executive Director of the San Francisco Bay Area Office of CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, and Abdul Sultani, ACLU Executive Director for Northern California. Before the break, Zahra, we were talking about the disappointment that many people feel with President Obama. People thought he would, you know, for one, the Patriot Act, you know, he even talked about it when he was campaigning. But you were talking about, you know, hold your elected officials responsible. Has that been happening so far, whether through CARE or the ACLU, Abdi? What have your groups been doing in that regard?
Well, the Patriot Act is obviously at the center of a lot of what we're talking about. It is the law that grants the government a great deal of authority, and yet, based on the documents that have been disclosed related to the NSA, it appears that the government went even beyond the authority that was pretty expansive to begin with. So this is now, you know, back on the center of the public debate, the Patriot Act. And the core thing, you know, thinking about President Obama or any of these things, is that, you know, we have a system of government that's founded with checks and balances. And those checks and balances happen within the institutions of government. So you have an independent judiciary to hold the executive branch accountable. And I think one of the problems with the way in which this whole system has evolved is the way in which there is not that independent judicial oversight. And even to the extent that they've provided, you know, some quasi-oversight, it's not with, you know, a system where, you know, the advocates for the other side can have a voice in it. But the other thing is that the dynamics of the Patriot Act are such that I think it's now really back on the table, and we're seeing a level of concern and outcry over the way in which the NSA has exceeded even that vast authority that it was granted to do mass warrantless data gathering, information gathering, and surveillance of Americans. And I think that The tide's going to turn on this, and I think more and more Americans are speaking up about it.
Okay. Let's go to some callers. We have full lines. People are calling in, but let me give you the number, 866-798-TALK, if you have a question or comment. So let's start with David in San Francisco. Welcome to your call.
Hi. Good morning. Nice to hear your show. I remember racial profiling back in the 60s. So, you know, when I was a college student at in Washington, D.C., and I was an underground newspaper writer, and I would be traveling to either Dulles or National or on the New Jersey Turnpike. And so I have no feeling that, I mean, I have a feeling that profiling has, you know, continued and, you know, will always be there. And I never, you know, I just accepted it. Because I was afraid that they would really change my whole, you know, flight plan, my destinations, because they didn't, there was something they didn't like. But they would just pull me aside, you know, and take me into an office and ask a couple of questions. And it's hard to remember. This was, you know, many years ago, and I don't remember, you know, whether they looked at luggage or whatever, but they certainly could have. And it was just taken for granted that that was going to happen. You know, I'm not Arab American. But I have a very ethnic look, so I look like some group that they didn't like, and they were suspicious of. So, so going to college in D.C., I always expected everything to be possible, you know. When I wasn't a conspiracist, but I just think that, you know, all this stuff went on, and, you know, in the newspaper group that we worked, there was a CIA agent that was later outed in Philip Agee's book. And so you had a feeling with this, that if you had a meeting of six people in a room just talking, that one person was an operative. So it continued on, and I just, you know, learned how to deal with it and accept it. And, you know, this is my look.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, David. Thanks for that call. Zahra, earlier we heard from Seema saying, you know, you just learn how to deal with it, you know. And now David is talking about, like, back in the 60s, he was profiled. And again, that comes up. You just learn how to deal with it. How should people deal with it? What are you telling people?
Well, we're telling people not to become complacent in the face of these civil liberties violations. To me, I would hope that learning how to deal with it would mean standing up to it, challenging it, seeking assistance, pushing back, because if we sort of just let it pass, nothing changes. And that's frightening not only for, you know, for the future of the individual who's facing the harassment, but also for their families, for their children, for their communities.
Right.
That
when we don't push back,
it's everybody.
Right.
Right.
I guess the idea is that, you know, I really don't want to cause problems, or, you know, they're going to delay me from my flight. It's inconvenient. So how do you make that balance of, you know, you need to stand up and kind of get that, you know, that activist-y feeling in you rather than just kind of be complacent? How do you convince people to do that?
I think it becomes a balancing act, right? Like, would I rather my privacy be invaded and that I'd be harassed and forced to, you know, suppress my identity, or would I rather risk missing a flight? And for me, and part of the work that CARE does in terms of working with the community and empowering the community is, you know, urging them to say, like, no, like, I'm not going to suppress my identity, but I want to practice my religion fearlessly, and that's part of what we value as people in the United States.
I think part of what we're really talking about here is the idea of loyalty. And for those of us who immigrate to this country, we feel a great affection and a great deal of loyalty to the country that embraces us and welcomes us. So I think part of the dynamic for, you know, any person who is in this situation is, you know, you don't want to criticize the government. You don't want to criticize this country because, you know, look, in the United States, we have tremendous freedom, we have tremendous opportunity, and we love that about this country. But I think what it means to be loyal is to be loyal to the First Amendment, to the principle of freedom of religion. And so if somebody feels that their mosque is being surveilled or if they are being targeted because of their religion, it's actually a loyal act as an American to speak up for that principle of freedom of religion and to call CARE or call ACLU or get a lawyer. I think similarly, the Fourth Amendment, that gives us our right to privacy. So if a government agent without a warrant, you know, wants to access our home or our mosque or some other place that's protected and private, it's a loyal thing to ask, do you have a warrant? And the 14th Amendment, that's what grants us equal protection under the law, regardless of race or national origin. And likewise, if people are targeted because of race or because of the, you know, the country that maybe they immigrated from, it's also loyal as an American to speak up for that value. So I think part of what we need to do is change the idea of loyalty, that embracing these values and speaking up for them is actually the most loyal thing we can do as Americans.
Okay, let's go to another caller. Let's go to Jacob in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to your call.
Yeah, hi. Every time I turn the news on radio, I hear a group of volunteers who are taking kids to a vaccination place in Nigeria, in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, getting killed, bombed. Afghanistan, anywhere, Pakistan, all the Islamic countries, people getting bombed, bomb-wearing Taliban, killing other Muslims in the name of one kind of religion or another, Shia against Sunni, etc., etc., etc. This is happening in the Muslim world every day. It's not without any reason that the FBI or whoever, law enforcement people anywhere in the world, are profiling Muslims. So instead of Muslims getting mad at people who are trying to stop them from killing other people, they should direct their energies toward other Muslims to teach them how to live like human beings instead of like animals like they do.
Okay. Thank you for your call.
Right.
Zahra or Abdi, anybody want to take that one? Zahra, go.
Sure. I mean, I would just say that what's happening in different parts of the world, will take more than an hour to discuss on radio. And, you know, is rooted in histories of colonization and ongoing wars. And so do the conflicts in the Middle East or the conflicts in Pakistan or Afghanistan, which, mind you, our government is an active part of, translate, or should they translate to civil liberties violations here? And I would argue that they shouldn't. And it's unfortunately part of a cycle, is that if we are fearful of people in other countries, then we must surveil them here. And that's a sort of a frightening place to be in.
All right. Let's go to more of your calls because these lines are full. But the number, again, is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can shoot us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's go to another David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to your call.
Hey, greetings. I'm sure glad I followed that last caller. It used to be that the freedom in America was a magnet for the world, and that all of the revolutionaries of the world, all of the creative people, the inventors, the free thinkers, would flock to America, or in some cases flee to America as a safety, as a haven. And the fact that basically we've allowed a bunch of bigots to so insult America and to so insult democracy that they have actually decimated what I would call the market forces of freedom, and the magnet being the market forces of freedom. And so the idea that these expensive bigots, they're historical in nature. You go back to the old witch trials of 500 and more years ago, and you basically, there are a number of books that talked about how that all fell apart because these bigots were profiteering. They would charge for how much rope they would use to tie up a witch and how much time they spent on food and all of the straw for their horses and their lodging. And these bigots would be able to chase people around, terrorize them around with their bigotry and profiteer from it. So when you start looking at the very idea that they have gone beyond chasing one guy, bin Laden, to now chasing a religion that is five times bigger than Christianity, And so we're now allowing these bigots to attack an entire religion, but using the financing of the what used to be the magnet of freedom. And so our stable economy based upon freedom is now being used to not only insult democracy and to insult freedom, but we're now it's totally turned it on its head. So the expensive bigots is what I would say is the problem here.
Okay, thank you, David in San Francisco. Abdi Sultani, would you like to comment on what David just said? That basically, you know, he says there's unlimited money to use for these racial profiling programs, and you know, it's as old as the Salem witch hunt.
You know, the thing with the way I look at it is, you know, not so much focused on the individual's motivations who might be behind some of these programs or policies, but I think it's inherent to institutions that once they have power, they try to grab more power. Once they have certain amount of resources, they want more resources. And that's why it's so important for there to be that system of checks and balances. You know, that's why our executive branch, our legislative branch, and our judicial branch are separate. And that's why we need robust judicial oversight over these kinds of government programs. But the other and most important part of the system of checks and balances is the people. We have a system of government where power emanates from people, and we need to have access to information. We need to be able to hold our government accountable. And you can't do that when so much of this infrastructure is walled off behind you know, that wall of secrecy that I was talking about earlier. I think that that's the way I look at it. The other thing, too, that I'm very mindful of, and I think we all need to be very attentive to, is as the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq wind down, you know, the technology and the infrastructure and the economy that's behind that is going to start to look for domestic markets. So drones, for example, we're seeing more and more attention as local jurisdictions. Right here in Alameda County, where I live, you know, the sheriff wants to get a drone. So a lot of the infrastructure that was deployed overseas, I think, is going to now start to turn to the domestic market. And I think we have to really be even more vigilant to ask tough questions about what's the purpose of that technology, what's the purpose of that expenditure, and how do we protect people's rights when those new tools are deployed.
Let's go to another caller. This time it's Thomas in Marin County. Hi, Thomas. Welcome to the show.
Yes, hello. I have just a comment, really, that it is unfortunate that on an anniversary of a second bombing of Twin Towers in New York City, first one coming maybe 6 years before, directly organized from a Muslim mosque in New Jersey. I'm really disappointed in your station not having a different opinion or second opinion among your guests. What you are having is just a simple propaganda piece that is reminiscent of my days in communist country, where there was never opposing view.
So what is your opinion, Thomas?
My opinion, well, I mean, I'm clearly there were some statements that are just not true. For instance, that the FBI is portraying Muslim culture as overly violent. Well, it's clearly that it's very violent. Every day you can look at front page, second page of any newspaper, you see innocent people blown up to pieces by either Sunni, Shia, or other sects, and it can be across the globe, from Nigeria to Iraq. And it is, you know, I really feel sorry for well-meaning Muslims, but they do need to reform the religion.
Right. And so you say that the conversation should be Muslims need to reform themselves and reform their religion and how they live, and therefore, until then, they should be surveilled and they should be profiled? Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, if you go to any airport today or any other day, you can see that 100% people are profiled. Nobody's luggage is exempt from checking, so we are all profiled. To say that my wife is blonde and it never fails, and anytime you go to the airport, that she is taken out and profiled, their luggage is screened very closely because if she just satisfies some kind of a quota for a non-Muslim to be scrutinized. So to say that somehow Muslims, it's just completely false, that statement.
Okay.
We are all victimized by the violence that came out of the Muslim world. I'm not going to historical background of it, but I wish somebody would just address that issue.
Okay.
Thank you, Thomas.
Abdi, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I talked earlier about the training materials that we had uncovered, and these are FBI counterterrorism training materials. And, you know, in one instance it says, quote, "the most important categorization made in establishing an ideological profile of a Muslim militant," end quote, "of a Muslim militant is," quote, "activism." You know, so here you have a characteristic of activism, which is actually like inherent to America. People participate in the political process, and they link that to an ideological profile of a militant Muslim. You know, another place they emphasize that if a person is critical of the United States policy in Iraq, Palestine, or, you know, Egypt, they could likely follow a militant ideology. So, you know, I think for the previous caller, you know, certainly we welcome open and public debate, and there could have been more guests on today's show. But I think the point here is that these are the practices of American government. These are the things that are done with our tax dollars, and we want to make sure that they uphold the values of this country. And those are freedom of religion, freedom of association, freedom of speech, you know, some protection from unreasonable search and seizure, and equal treatment under the law. You know, what Muslims do to Muslims, or what some Muslims do to some Muslims, you know, that's a conversation that people can have. And in a free society, we would have that conversation, and we should have any conversation we want to have. Without that conversation, then getting you in an FBI database just because you express a point of view about a religion.
We have an email from I.C. Yesil Yurt in Cupertino. I'd met the FBI agent and his wife, who is also an FBI agent, both nice people, by the way. They were assigned to our South Bay Islamic Association on many occasions at Eid festivals, open houses, and family night at our center. It was such a mixed feeling to see them there. I wanted to believe that they were there to protect us against threats because we had break-ins in our center. Yet I know their main purpose to be there was to spy on us. We have also read and heard that there were undercover agents among mosque-goers, too, as the one who wreaked havoc in L.A. mosques. The undercover person pretended to convert to Islam, trying to entice people to get involved in terrorist acts against the community they live in. People in the area complained about him, and he was exposed. And she says, just imagine the breakdown of the trust among people after such examples. Zahra, what would you say for cases like that? But we also have heard today from Jacob in San Francisco and Thomas in Marin County, you know, on the other hand, saying, well, wait a minute, you know, Muslims are doing all of these things around the world and they're bombing and they're having all these conflicts. Yes, I should be afraid of them. And yes, you should profile them. And by the way, everyone's being profiled.
So let's start with everyone's being profiled. I think it was a little problematic for the caller to say that we hadn't acknowledged that everybody was being profiled. Specifically in the conversation about NSA surveillance, we said everybody is being surveilled, that if anything, that American Muslims are saying, look, like what's happening to all Americans has been happening to us for a very long time. So I don't think that either of us would disagree that everybody is being profiled and that's problematic. In terms of, you know, Muslim-on-Muslim violence or the likelihood of terrorism from the Muslim community, overwhelmingly still, statistics show that you are more likely to die from gun violence. You are more likely to die from falling in the shower than you are to die from a Muslim terrorist attack. And so I would thank CalW for having progressive voices on to talk about civil liberties issues that we're facing, because the idea that Muslims are more prone to violence than others, I would put forward, is sort of imaginary, that it's not actually based in fact, that statistically speaking, you're more likely to die at the hands of the U.S. military than you are at the hands of a Muslim terrorist in some cases. And so with that said, what do we recommend that people do? We know from history that the Muslim community is just the flavor of the day when it comes to civil liberties violations, is that in the last 100 years, we've targeted Japanese Americans, we've targeted black and brown people that we suspected of being drug dealers, we've targeted people of all backgrounds who we suspected of being communist. And so when the period for Muslim harassment passes, our civil liberties as Americans aren't restored. They stay in the state that they're in. And so the next group, whether it's Occupy organizers or internet hackers or whoever else that we decide to target as a country, is going to suffer from that. And so we all have a vested interest in, you know, in putting our foot down and saying that we won't permit our civil liberties to be further eroded. What we tell American Muslims is that they should assert their rights, that they have a right to be free and safe in their places of worship, that they should not have to worry about law enforcement surveillance. And that's different from being able to call law enforcement for help. And we make that distinction, is that it is law enforcement's job to serve us, to serve and protect our communities. And so irrespective of whether or not I'm okay with talking about religion and politics to the FBI, I should be able to call them when there's a hate crime. I should be able to call the local police department when my center is broken into. But we also need to put down some lines in the sand, and that includes not having agents visiting our mosques to talk religion and politics.
Okay. And a final thought from you, Abdi Sultani. We have 20 seconds left. Final words.
You know, my main thing is that, you know, I'm grateful every day to live in a great country that has the values that this country has. And I think that it's all of our job as Americans to, you know, protect those values and uphold them in everything that we do. And it's a pleasure to be on the show, and welcome all the conversation today. Thank you.
Thank you. That's Abdi Sultani of the ACLU. And with us also is Zahra Bilu from CARE. Thank you both for joining us. Thanks for your emails and your phone calls. Sorry we couldn't get to all of you. I'm Hanat Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call.
How has the drug war affected you? We'll have a conversation with Eugene Jarecki, filmmaker behind the documentary The House I Live In, which captures heart-wrenching stories from individuals at all levels of America's war on drugs. So far, the drug war has lasted 40 years, cost $1 trillion, and led to 45 million arrests. But what have we accomplished? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.